You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra Siam, Nisiam, Nisiaya, Anthasiakulia, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustail. Hey there, you've got it tuned to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory at the University of British Columbia. Well, today we have another special presentation from Literasian from their Asian Heritage Month 2021 programming. Today we have the Pendergai Radio Collective 1976 to 1981, The Reunion Show. The Pendergai Radio Collective grew out of a wave of Chinese-Canadian youth activism in the early 1970s. Running their operations from Vancouver's Chinatown and airing on Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, the show explored issues related to the Chinese-Canadian identity, history, politics, and art through news reporting, interviews, humor, drama, and music. Produced entirely by volunteers, the Pendergai offered a way for young Chinese Canadians to gain community media skills and counter mainstream media representations of Chinatown and Chinese Canadians. With the City of Vancouver's archives' recent digitization of the audio tapes, these tapes are now accessible entirely online, becoming an oral history archive of a formative period of Asian Canadian history. Listen now as members of the Pendergai share their favorite memories from the show and play some of their favorite tape, while the community activists who helped preserve and document the show share the importance of the Pendergai archives to the community both locally and internationally. Today's speakers include Paul Yee, Ramona Marr, Tommy Tao, Jeannie Young, Christy Fong, and Rachel Lau, and it's moderated by Winnie L. Chung.
Good morning, good afternoon. You are now with us for the Pendergai Radio Collective, the reunion show. My name is Winnie Chung, and I'm operating from my home in Burnaby, which is the traditional and unceded territories and homelands of the Musqueam and Squamish-speaking people. I'm going to go around the room here so that you have an idea who is in the room here with us on the screen. Starting on the left-hand side, we have Cindy Chan Piper, and she will be representing ACW. And the speakers today, we're so pleased to have so many alumni, the young people from the 70s who started the show. I'm going to start with Ramona on the top right-hand corner. And joining us too, we have Jeannie, I'm going downwards now, Jeannie Young, and Paul Yee all the way from Toronto joining us today. And across the left-hand side, we have another young person from the 70s, Tommy Tao. And with us today also, we have the current young people, and that is Christy Fong, just above Tommy here, and also Rachel Lau in the lower row between the two gentlemen here. And in the middle, someone who has been holding this together and working behind the scenes for us is Sophie Meng. And I also take this chance to acknowledge a person who has been working behind the scenes and doesn't appear on the screen. And one is Alan Chow, the executive director of ACWW, who really is pulling everything together for us. And also a heroine who doesn't want to show herself today, that is June Chow. And we'll be hearing later how she has been helping us get this together. So without much ado, I'm going to invite, first of all, Cindy to bring greetings. And then afterwards, each of the speakers will be given some time to help us understand what this program is all about and so on and so forth. Okay, so first of all, Cindy, please.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for today's festival event. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Cindy Chan Piper, and I am ACWW's representative. I recognize that we're all logged on to this webinar from different territories. I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge that I'm speaking to you from my home in Vancouver on the unceded homelands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. I acknowledge all the nations who have cared for the land, recorded and unrecorded, and I'm grateful to have a home here. I also want to acknowledge the kindness that First Nations people have shown our early Chinese pioneers when they first came to this country. The Literation Festival is really the first of its kind within Canada, with an important mandate to promote and celebrate the works of Asian Canadian writers and artists through author readings, panel discussions, and workshop events. In doing so, we create an important and unique networking opportunity between professional and emerging writers, students, and members of the broader public to learn and discuss topics of importance to Asian Canadian writing. Launched in 2013, Literation is an annual festival of Pacific Rim Asian Canadian writing and community building initiative of the Asian Canadian Writers Workshop. See my nifty t-shirt? This is the second time that we are holding our festival virtually and to a worldwide audience. A big shout out to everyone from across the world who are watching us from the comfort of their homes and offices. Thank you for sharing your time with us from whatever time zone you're in. Thank you to our partners and sponsors, the BC Arts Council, World Vancouver Festival, Pacific Canada Heritage Center, Iron Dog Books, Chinatown Youth Collaborative, BC Artscape, the historic Joy Kogawa House, Dart Helix Press. I also want to thank the wonderful team of ACWW volunteers and our festival coordinator, Sophie Monk. Thank you to all of the publishers who provided the author's books. Each book is for sale at the sales table. If you're in Vancouver, go to Iron Dog Books. Before I introduce our moderator today, I'd like to say hi to all us old timers from Pendergai. Look at this original card. Brings back memories, huh? So I'd like to introduce our moderator, Winnie Chung. Winnie is an international and intercultural educator, art lover, history buff, and published writer in English and Chinese. She thinks that all communities must be involved to create better understanding between first-generation immigrants and local-born Asian Canadians, Indigenous peoples, and other settlers, and that this can be enhanced through the creative power of artists and storytellers working to build the cultural silos in our increasingly diverse and sometimes segmented society. In the local community, she plays a leadership advisory role in many vital organizations, including the Laurier Institute, the Vancouver Asian Heritage Month Society, the Asian Canadian Writers Workshop Society, and the Chinese Cultural Center. She is also a co-founder and past president of the Pacific Canada Heritage Center, Museum of Migration Society. So, please welcome Winnie.
Thank you, Cindy. That's very kind of you. I didn't expect that I would be introduced. So, thank you. I am doing this naturally because I have been very, very keen in supporting ACWW, but also as a representative of PCHC, Museum of Migration Society, we have been working with ACWW on many, many programs. And storytelling is our business. So this is just perfect for us. And I'm being a very curious person. I always want to find out how things come about. And when I first arrived in Vancouver in the 80s, I already heard so much about Pendergai, the radio program. But of course it was before my time. So I never had a chance to really find out what it was all like. So Today, we are on a journey. We'll be getting it from the horse's mouth. And the first one who is going to let us know about how this came about was one of the founders. But before I invite Paul to speak, I just want to point out that among the audience, if there are alumni of this radio show, please identify yourself using the Q&A function. Sophie will be monitoring that for us. And later after the presentations, we will go and look at the questions. And if you like, we can invite you to show your face on the screen as well, because after all, this is a reunion show. So without much ado, I'm going to briefly introduce someone who's so well known, he doesn't need any introduction. Paul Yee. Paul was trained as a historian, and right after his graduation with a master's degree from UBC, he started working as an archivist. He worked first in the City of Vancouver's archives and also later in the archives of Ontario. But being a very talented person, apart from all the social activist activities, he also put together exhibitions, and the most famous one that I heard about when I first arrived was Saltwater City, Ham Sui Fau. That exhibition later turned into more than a book, and he's the go-to person when people want to find out anything about Vancouver's Chinese Canadian communities. As you know, he's a famous published writer. He's written books both for children as well as for adults. And because the clip that he has chosen, even though we're not playing the clip right now, the clip that he's chosen from the radio show is Super Panda Guy, that reminded me of his latest book, A Superior Man, right? The word super reminds me of that, Superman. So here is our Superman, Paul Yee.
Hi, thanks for having me on this panel. I'm delighted to discuss my favorite piece from the Panda Guy archives. First, let me say this. It's important to note that over the course of Panda Guy's complicated life, the many people who came onto the program all had very different reasons and motivations for getting involved. And all those reasons are valid and important. The commitment of those volunteers was very, very real. And I salute all of them. So what I'm gonna tell you about now really only applies to me about why I got involved and why I wrote that particular piece. So to give you a sense of my choice, let me read the opening to Super Panda Guy, The Origins. I must warn you that my reading is nowhere as good as what Barry Wong's original voiceover work was. But here goes anyways. Faster than a Trans Am on the proposed Chinatown freeway, more powerful than an urban renewal bulldozer, can leap over City Hall's pile of red tape in a single bound. Wow, look up there in the sky. It's a bird. No, it's a plane. No, it's Panda Guy. Super Panda Guy uses superhuman powers when the need arises in a never-ending struggle to combat the insidious, ever-lurking forces of racism, the threat of unthinking assimilation, the menace of lying stereotypes, and other evil murderers of Chinese-Canadian culture. So that gives you an idea of the exaggerated and hopefully entertaining work that we were doing back in the 1970s. So now I'd like to go back to that time, the 60s and 70s, for some context to explain Super Panda Guy and to connect sort of the political with the personal. So in the mid-1970s, when I started volunteering in Chinatown, I read a very influential critique of the Chinese-Canadian world. Now, the 60s and the 70s were very, I guess, heady times. In America, the civil rights movement fought for African-Americans, students were protesting the Vietnam War, new parties like the Black Panther Party arose, there were terrible race riots, and Afro-American Studies started at American universities. Now, these events affected the three largest Asian groups in America at that time, the Chinese, Japanese, and Filipinos. Now, their English-speaking youth came forth and demanded Asian-American studies at universities. They also demanded more engagement with the Chinatowns, Little Tokyos, Little Manilas, Japantown, International District, the areas where the pioneers and senior citizens faced issues around language, isolation, housing, and social services. And these calls challenged the assimilation model that flourished then. Now, that trend reflected decades of anti-Asian racism in both the US and Canada that had seen the exclusion of Chinese immigrants and the World War internment, the World War II internment of Japanese Americans and Japanese Canadians. Now, after the war, mainstream North America became more accepting of racial minorities. So the thinking was the locally born Asians should become as American or as Canadian as possible and leave behind the dark history of racism and embrace all the opportunities of the mainstream world. And that's how I was raised in Vancouver of the 1960s. I hated going to Chinese school. I yearned to move away from Chinatown to a better neighborhood. And I shrugged at the Chinese community, whatever that was. But all that changed after high school. In 1972, the Wakayama Group of Vancouver published an article in Bridge Magazine with the title, "Why Are There So Few Sansei Writers?" Now, the word Sansei refers to the third generation of the Japanese diaspora. And the article compared the output of novels, poetry, and literary work written by Asian Americans, Asian Canadians, which was very low, compared to the output of African Americans and Jewish Americans, which was impressively high. So why were there so few Asian Canadian writers? The Wakayama Group said that because as the English-speaking generations integrated into the mainstream white society, they let go of their mother tongues, they let go of their ties to their communities, and they bought into whatever the mainstream narrative was for us. So if the mainstream said minorities didn't need their own literature, well, that was fine. If the mainstream said race discrimination was dead, we believe them. The Wakayama Group argued that as long as the English-speaking generations of Asian Canadians didn't know their history in Canada and didn't identify with their own people, then they would be forever lacking a spiritual gut from which to tell their truths in stories, poetry, or whatever. Now, this is probably obvious now in 2021. But back in the 1970s, this was radical. I tell you, it was radical. And not a lot of Asian Canadians were comfortable talking about this. But I found that analysis fit me. I wasn't comfortable in Chinatown despite growing up there. I knew nothing about Chinese Canadian history. And I thought I knew everything about how to grow up as a racial minority. But that Wakayama Group article changed me. Because now I felt like I belonged to a community. And with that sense of belonging came an urgency to do more. I had never wanted to write. Now I did. I never thought I had anything important to write about. Now I did. I never thought my family was worth exploring and writing about. And now I did. Now I saw that my family and I were part of a larger whole, part of a Chinese Canadian world that had its own past as well as stories about how to thrive here in Canada. I belonged to a community and everybody around me could be empowered if they could see how their own family and their own lives contributed to the larger whole that we were all in. And suddenly the comic books that I had gobbled up as a kid looked very different. looking back now, that mini-series Super Pender Guy responded to the question from the Wakayama group. I was younger then. I knew only the easy pieces of Chinese-Canadian history, yet I wanted to write. I wanted to say, yeah, we can change those words, so few, in that title. And so we wanted to write. And Pender Guy, the radio program, offered us a chance to be heard. Radio was cheap compared to staging a play. It required less time than writing a novel, and it didn't require the extensive skills needed to go on TV. So that was step one. With a superhero, we were working within a familiar genre, the comic book genre, and with the golden age of radio formats from the 1940s and 1950s that had been all powerful in North America. We wanted an alternative, a hero from our history and our community. And the comic book genre was loaded with standard features. The superhero has a secret identity as a normal person. The setting is in a big city where there's excitement and danger. And the hero has a mythic backstory to explain where those superpowers come from. And of course, the hero is called upon to go on dangerous quests. We spoofed the genre. So for example, our language was filled with cliches, like meanwhile, back on the railway tracks, or we gave the villains these terrible lines like, we're gonna take it to Toronto, see, and you're gonna help us, see, or we'll make your father disappear, see. And our hero says, where do you guys learn to talk like that? Anyways, so the end product was loaded with special effects from the sound studio, you know, echo chambers, Star Wars type music, interludes, all to create the right atmosphere. And Super Pender Guy was a chance to be creative, to give free rein to our imagination. We poked fun at the dominant culture and at ourselves. We made a Chinatown of our own imagination. But the more important thing was we were all young then and we could take chances and we wanted to have some fun. Thank you. Back to you, Winnie.
Thank you so much, Paul. This is really interesting. I have more questions now, but I'm going to hold the questions and wait for to hear more from one of the early participants. And the next speaker that I'm going to call upon is Ramona Ma. Now, unlike the others who were on the show, I think Ramona could have been the only professional. She was trained in BCIT in broadcast journalism. And in fact, she was already working for a station. When she heard about, or when she met the crew from Pender Guy, and she got so interested at what these young people are doing that she decided to offer herself as well. So she joined the team and she was working between the two stations of working from one station to another, straddling both worlds. Later, in her professional career, she was a newscaster on CFMI, and then she moved to CBC, where she co-hosted two television series. And of course, there's much more that she has done. By the time I met her, I remember precisely the occasion. She and Tommy were emceeing a very special show during Asian Heritage Month. It was an orchestra, and they were the voices telling the story behind it. So over to you, Ramona.
Thanks, Winnie. Actually, Tommy and I were reading a poem that we had commissioned Paul Yee to do for the Vancouver Youth Symphony Orchestra. Thanks for remembering that. Well, thanks everyone for being here, and especially to ACCW for bringing us together today. Out of chronological order, because if Paul gets to be known as a Pender Guy founder, I think that makes me a Pendergai loser because I joined the show in the final year and a half of its life. I was a late bloomer to my Chinatown awakening, having spent my teens in mostly white middle-class Burnaby and gone to SFU, not UBC. I hadn't heard about or knew anything about Pendergai until I attended a meeting at the CBA to cover CTV's offensive W5 episode for the Chinatown News. And at that time, I was just starting broadcast journalism school, also in white middle-class Burnaby. In other words, youth and Chinatown were basically unexplored for me. So you can be sure I was curious about these young microphone-carrying nerds at that meeting, and I signed up happily to volunteer. But since I was coming from a wannabe journalism background, current affairs became my focus and my main contribution. I did try my hand at what I thought were more poetic and creative scripts, but as it turns out, I'm not that poetic or funny, and I learned comedy is really hard to pull off. So you know what, when Super Pendergai, when I heard that, I was like, so in such awe. The episode I want to discuss is a true life story, which put me in the awkward zone of being participant and journalist. In class, I was learning that reporting on something that actually happened to you was frowned upon, for one. The goal was to aim for objectivity, but from whose point of view? If you wanted to work in mainstream media, then obviously that point of view is the white mainstream majority. But Pendergai gave us the freedom to report from our perspective. So I'll try to summarize what happened. In 1979, I was entertaining a group of Chinese American friends visiting from the Bay Area. This was the era of disco, so you know what, park your judgment somewhere else. I took them to the candy store disco at the Royal Center and was told by the Chinese Canadian doorman there that the entry fee was $5. Well, that's a cup of coffee today, but back then, that $5 could practically pay for the silver-plated urn it was served in. Suffice to say, we decided to have wholesome fun somewhere else. And as we were leaving, one of my Vancouver friends said, you know, they always charge Chinese $5 and whites $3. I was so shocked that I actually went into a phone booth and stuck in my dime and called the candy store to inquire what was the entry fee tonight. And they said $3. I took my outrage to what was then the British Columbia Human Rights branch, and we did an investigation. And in the end, we settled with the owners and received a public apology in the newspaper and a total of $500, which we donated to the Chinese Cultural Center. My friends and I also went to City Hall to argue why the disco should have its license lifted, and we lost. All this is recorded in the Pendergai episode, a half-hour documentary produced with Keeman Wong and Barry Wong. We recount the story and discuss similar cases of discrimination against Black patrons at Misty's Disco. We interviewed participants, human rights advocates, community activists, and the colorful, outspoken city alderman at the time, Harry Rankin. That documentary, along with one that Keeman produced on the W5 protest, won Co-op Radio the B'nai B'rith Media Human Rights Award in 1980. For the first time, Pendergai was actually in the news and being honored in the mainstream. Hallelujah! We were just thrilled someone was listening. If you do hear this episode, I apologize wholeheartedly for allowing the use of the word Oriental, which now offends my ears. 42 years ago, though, the word was still in common usage, although with some growing discomfort. I've heard Henry Yu say the term Asian is the word that replaces Oriental. I also used the pseudonym Judy Wong for that story, in part because I was getting some anonymous telephone calls at home and I was worried it was connected to having spoken out. And then by then I was also working for radio news at CFMI under my own name. But I digress. Reliving that episode four decades later, it does not surprise me or shock me that anti-Asian racism is alive and well in this time of COVID. We have long been scapegoated throughout our history here. And in that context, I don't find the current hate as outrageous as I would have had if I would have when I was in my 20s. I still don't know what to do about it, other than to point it out, argue for education and stand by other minorities when it happens to them. Sometimes it feels that settler colonial Canada has made great strides in embracing us all, and other times I know we are still viewed as foreigners. I went down the rabbit hole in preparing for today and had the pleasure of listening to other episodes of Pendergai that I'd never heard before. It gave me a renewed sense of pride in what we accomplished over those 5 years. And we weren't there together, although I never had the privilege of being in the studio with you, Paul, or Jeannie, or you, Tommy. I know that we all shared the desire to reflect the diversity of the Chinese Canadian experience, to speak truthfully and boldly, to use as much creativity as we could muster to get our views across as full Canadians. In radio, our voices could be heard without the complications and assumptions being made by seeing the color of our hair or the shape of our eyes. Maybe that gave us the freedom to be so expressive. As I said, we really had no idea who was listening on the other side of the radio, but I do know the people on our side of the microphone were all transformed in some way. I feel as if I grew up when I joined Pendergai. It's when I came to understand that I needed to look behind me and beside me to acknowledge and celebrate our presence here and to determine which way we wanted to go. I'd like to think the show and its ideas are just as relevant today as they were in 1976. And it makes me wonder if anyone out there would like to restart a program such as this. There's new energy and a much more diverse and open Chinese Canadian presence now. And all you have to do is call it a podcast with a Chinese Canadian perspective. Thank you for indulging me in taking this trip down memory lane with us. A special hello to any of the former 65 or so Pendergai members who might be Zooming in today. And thank you also to allow me to give a warm shout out to Barry Wong, the one constant Pendergai member who was there from beginning to the end and to this day keeps the show alive and its philosophy. Finally, I just want to talk about preserving the tapes. They have a sad effect of shedding or degrading over time, and it's been a long journey. We are indebted to Co-op Radio for keeping our large wooden cabinet in which the master tapes were stored long after we folded, to the Chinese Canadian Library Service Association, who opened their doors and made room for that said cabinet, then to the Museum of Anthropology, where they were taken from my basement and treated to a temperature-controlled environment by the experts there. And finally, to the City of Vancouver Archives, full circle for you, Paul, which received the tapes and a grant last year to digitize them. I hope the shows will remain a treasure for researchers and anyone interested in the issues that affected Chinatown. And I invite you all to dip in and listen and discover what relevance you may find for your own journeys. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Ramona. Now I'm getting a clearer picture about this mystery, how these tapes were preserved and then resurfaced and now restored so that we can actually hear the voices from 40 some years ago. And a lot of the topics that you dealt with are still very relevant today. So I hope that after this show, many more people will go and listen to those tapes. Thank you. Our next speaker is Tommy Tao. I first heard about Tommy when he was running in a federal election. I think it's federal. Yeah. And yes, and I think he later told me that it's much better that he is not a politician, because then we would benefit, because he's not just a lawyer. That was just the day job. Other than day job, he's a writer, he's a translator, he's a poet. And we don't remember his lawyer's work, but we do enjoy and still talk about, and I still keep your books and read your poetry from time to time. So off to you, Tommy. How did you get involved with these local people when you were a new immigrant yourself and you started in 1968? I think you moved from Hong Kong with your parents. to Toronto, but you found your way to Vancouver and got involved with Panda Guides. Off to you.
Thank you very much, Winnie, for the introduction. And I want to thank the organizers as well as the participants today for this opportunity for me to give a long overdue word of thanks to Panda Guy and all the friends that I've made through Panda Guy. That experience remains very, very important in my life. Although my involvement in Panda Guy was not long, it was just for a brief few months, up to a year, I think, couldn't have been that long. But the episode that I've chosen is the very first program number one. segment number six, which was the part that I co-hosted with Barry Wong. And listening to it after 40 years really is fabulous. that segment was entitled Between Us Chinese. It was the name was taken from the title of a conference, a youth conference, under the name of Between Us Chinese, which was to explore the relationship between the native-born and the immigrant Chinese-Canadian, and the negative stereotyping that we tend to have of each other, and the challenge or challenges that those negative stereotyping have created for us. That challenge remains throughout the 40 years ever since, with every wave of new immigrants, with every generation of new immigrants, we have different negative stereotyping. And things get even more complicated because then we have negative stereotypes between new immigrants and old immigrants, you know. Immigrants from Taiwan, immigrants from Hong Kong, immigrants from mainland China, immigrants from wherever. The Chinese diaspora is very diverse, and we have all sorts of negative stereotypings. You know, we look down upon each other, you know, let alone all of us being looked down upon by others in the so-called mainstream society. We look down upon others within our own community. So that challenge remains with us, and it's getting more and more complicated, really. The episode, as I said, was the very first production of Panda Guy, produced way back on July 18, 1976. And it featured Barry Wong as the boisterous, outgoing native-born, and myself as the quiet and studious immigrant. And the idea was that, you know, as I said, we had stereotypical views of each other, which kind of prevented us from engaging with or befriending each other. And that if we could just get over such barriers, we would learn from each other and we could help each other. Well, it certainly worked for me. I mean, getting involved on that program, befriending or, you know, being friends with people like Barry and Paul and Ramona and so many others, was very important to me at the time. It worked for me. I learned from my native-born friends, and my Penegai experience helped me very much. Although I was supposedly a co-producer of a segment of the program, I was honestly more of a tag along admirer, you know? It was just fascinating. It was magical. It was wonderful. I mean, I can remember that echo in my head, you know, Penegai, you know? It's fascinating. I was at that time a 28-year-old. I was a mature student at UBC. Having returned to school after a few disastrous years in Toronto, not being able to adjust to the first year university life then at the U of T. I really made a mess of myself. But Vancouver gave me a new start, and Penegai was really important, you know, thinking back on it. Even though my time, as I said, was brief, it was a very, very important and crucial opportunity for me at the time. I was, you know, a new immigrant. I was unsure about myself, unsure about my future, and unsure about my identity. You know, although I had already become a Canadian citizen, I must say, you know, I wasn't convinced that Canada was my new home. I was still thinking perhaps it would be better, you know, sometime in the future, if possible, for me to return to Hong Kong or China, even though I was brought up in Hong Kong. So I guess in my mind, I was still thinking very much about Hong Kong, that eventually that's where, you know, I would be more comfortable. But I think Penegai made a real difference for me, as it was. It made me feel like I belong to the community of Chinese Canadians. And it also enabled me to embrace the 100-plus year Chinese Canadian history as my own. It also enabled me to further broaden my identity as an Asian Canadian. And it's even more important today. I think that idea is even more important today, that we're not, you know, just Chinese Canadians. We are Asian Canadians. Of course, we are Canadians, but we have levels of identity. And seeing that, you know, as Asian Canadians, we share common challenges, and we see others overcoming those challenges, and we learn from them. And we help each other. That's a very, very important lesson that I think we have learned, and we benefit from that learning. I think that experience with Penegai really empowered me to subsequently, as an activist in Chinatown, to advocate for the redress movement of the Japanese Canadians first, and then later for the Chinese Canadian head tax redress. And even later on, advocacy for the removal of the notwithstanding clause from our Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Although, of course, our effort was didn't come to fruition, there was no result. But I think you know, the experience with that that organization, that group was called Coalition 33. That was important. It involved Andy Joe. He was the one who dragged me along and made me chair of that Coalition 33, which lasted for 5 years. But I think those kind of experience, the advocacy work, the equality rights work, really made me believe that I belong, that I am a Canadian, that I have fought for important issues, that I can raise my voice, whether or not I succeed or our group succeed, is really secondary. The fact that we can work together, that we can raise our voice, that we try, that we fight together, I think that's important. That make me believe and made me a real Canadian. And that's why long time ago, I have forgotten about ever returning to Hong Kong. I won't ever have that as a dream anymore. My dream is to do my very best to make Canada a better place for other immigrants who come, and for native born, for our children, for your children, to make this a better place. And that's why I really think my experience, as I said, short, brief as it was important. Pendegai was important. And the friendship that people like you, Paul and Ramona and Barry, and I have to say, Jim Wong Chu, although he wasn't really a native born, he was virtually a native born. I am so grateful that that you embraced me as a friend and welcomed me into, you know, the family of Chinese Canadians. Well, what can I give back in return? I have an idea. As an immigrant, I think, and I would like to be able to tell my native-born friends a story of our ancestral Chinese people. And the way I want to tell it, I think I can tell it, is through the poetry of 100 generations of poets. That's 3,000 years of Chinese poetry. By choosing out of those millions of poems, I can't read millions, but close to. I think, you know, I've worked on it for the past 20 years, and I think I now have much of the materials I need to choose from the numerous well-written poems, to choose something like 100, or better still, 99. I think always not quite reaching the number is a good idea. So 99 poems to tell a story. And I think just recently I have found the thread that would piece together the poems to tell a story. Of course, it can only be a story, right? There is no the story. There can only be a story. A story of our ancestral Chinese people. And I think it would be a good thank you gift I can give back to you, my friends. I will keep working on it. I will stay safe, keep well, and God willing, get it done. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tommy. We look forward to those 99 poems. And it looks like since you are retired, a number of us do have some time, maybe we should start Tender Guy again with the young people. Let them do the work and then we can help at the back, okay? Now, before I invite Jenny Yang to speak, I think I'll take a moment to say that we've been saying Panda Guy, assuming people know what it means, because I don't know who is actually among the audience, so I'm going to do the obvious. Panda Guy is, of course, it refers to Panda's treat, which is the most important street a lot of us go up and down on when we go to Chinatown in Vancouver. So street in Cantonese is guy. So these people who started with this catchy name, Panda Guy Radio Show, they're playing on the pun, and it is a cross-linguistic kind of pun. Right? Panda Guy is those guys from Panda Street, as well as the street Panda Street. Okay, so I'm just stating the obvious. Now, I'm going to introduce Jenny. She, to me, is a real native of Panda Guy, Panda Street, because she was born there on Panda Street. Well, they lived on Panda Street. She said she was born there and went to school in Strathcona Elementary and Britannia. That is the pathway for a lot of people, a whole generation growing up in Chinatown, Vancouver. She got her degree from UBC and worked there for 30 some years in the education faculty. Her degree is in food sciences, agriculture, but she is doing much more than that. And in her retirement, she's still very, very engaged, providing services to a number of community organizations and doing shopping for elders and so on and so forth. So maybe Jenny will run off the original stories and perhaps tell us why such a good program that meant so much to the participants would close at the end of 5 years. Jenny. You have to unmute yourself.
Sorry, now can you hear me? Thank you, Winnie, and thank you for this ACCW for hosting this session and all the background people, Alan Cho, that organized this webinar. It's so wonderful to see the faces of Paul Yi, Ramona Mar, and Tommy To. I've heard of you guys, but I never had a chance to work together with you in the studios. As for Paul Yi, he's my childhood friend. We went to Strathcona, Britannia together, and even Mun Crown School. So I'm excited to talk about Tender Guy today. Actually, my name was Jeannie Chow, was listed on the Tender Guy record. In 1976, I met Barry Wong, one of the original members of Tender Guy, and he invited me to join the group. At that time, I was studying at UBC in biochem/food science, and I finished my studies in 1978. And later on, I started working for Food Talk, a government project, as a community worker and nutrition educator for disadvantaged groups in East Vancouver. But all through that time, I was going downtown, walking down to the Panda Guy studios and participating in the programs. And we volunteers would go meet in the evenings at the studio that Jim Wong Chu rented and work on all our segments to put together for the radio program. As an elder brother to us, Jim, I thank Jim for his generosity. And a few years back, Jim passed away due to a stroke, so we missed him very dearly, as he was a great influence in the community, encouraging many writers and artists. I like to talk about the segments I was involved in the Pendergai program. One of the highlights that you guys will put a link to was my interview with the owner and worker, William, of On Tea Garden on 214 East Kiefer. It was invaded by Pierre and Margaret Trudeau. And for you younger folks, they were the parents of Justin Trudeau. I was surprised to learn that the restaurant opened in 1955 and was a popular spot for local people to frequent. After the Trudeau's visit, many Caucasians tried out the restaurant. There were very long lineups, even on the rainy day that I interviewed people. The consensus was that the prices were reasonable and food was delicious. With Pendergai, I was very interested in the members of the community, and I wanted to find out how they contributed to Chinatown. So another interview I did was a person in the community that I admired a lot. He was Father Peter Chow, who headed the Chinese Catholic Church in Chinatown. And many people attended his church and benefited from the services. So I don't know whether you guys remember him, Paul or Tommy. I also interviewed a Chinese Canadian gent, Wenis Ng, who was the manager of Dimples Discotheque that was a short walk away from our Vancouver Co-op radio station on Pigeon Square. I was at the corner of Carroll Street and Hastings Street. I was curious how he felt about working as a Chinese Canadian in the discotheque. And lastly, I did a workshop on air on how to make soybean curd, tofu. Baking soybean curd with a coagulating agent was my bachelor's thesis in food science at UBC. This healthy food, low in cholesterol, is consumed by so many people nowadays. I think back to high school, Peter Chow, my Britannia classmate, his family operated the Sunrise Grocery and Tofu Place on Powell and Gore Street. And his company is still a major BC producer of tofu products. I also hosted a number of Pendergai programs, collecting segments from different contributors every week. And some programs covered social justice issues and others covered lighter topics. I really loved the segments that Barry Wong and Paul did on Super Pendergai. I hope that you listeners will be able to click on the links and listen to those plays. Actually, I wanted to give you a background on my life in Chinatown, because in my youth, I lived in Chinatown for 25 years since my birth. I remember the vibrant community in the 60s and 70s. It was a safe place to go to with many families of several generations coming to shop for their groceries, buy barbecue meat, grab Chinese bakery items, and do other errands. Either the people lived in the area or they came from outside. In the 60s and 70s, Chinatown was a major Chinese center. There was no Crystal Mall in Burnaby or Chinese malls or stores in Richmond. Chinese people from all over Vancouver would come down to Chinatown to do the shopping and go to restaurants. So my parents would often take me out and we would see the street swamped with people. It was so busy. And at one instance, one Chinese grandma approached me and said, because she was illiterate, she said, "Could you tell me how much this vegetable costs?" I would read out the sign to her. And it felt wonderful to help her out. That's what we did in our community. I noticed that many of the Chinese would frequent the many noodle shops, restaurants, and they go explore around the area. Others would go to the community center, Chinese Cultural Center, or religious services, I often see parents bring their children down to attend one of the three existing Chinese schools that held classes on Mondays to Fridays from 4 to 6 p.m. That was my life too, attending Munkeong School on East Pender Street. The other schools were Wakyu, which was on, I think, Jackson and East Pender, and Dai Gong Chinese School, which was on Carroll Street in East Pender. So hundreds of students attended these three schools at that time. As for my family, we ran the Ming Ford grocery stores in the 50s and 60s at 626 Main Street. And we lived upstairs in two small rooms. We struggled to survive, but we were content with what we had. I remember my dad never mentioned the racism he experienced since he came to Canada in 1910. I've never heard him say anything negative. I just felt that he just dwelled on the positive and did not think about other things. I'd like to tell you about the block that I lived in. My memory is my neighborhood, walking south on Main Street from Kiefer. On the east side was a small corner store operated by a European lady. I used to go there and buy candy from her. And there were one-ton shops on the block. As one walked further south, the Tosi Italian food store occupied two storefronts. It's been written up on the Vancouver Sun. Tosi's has been opened for over 100 years. And I saw the original owner, Mr. Tosi, working in the 70s until his death. His son Angelo took over, and the store is still there. At age 86, Angelo still loves to keep his store open. So please go and visit him. He has the best prosciutto, cheese, and different kinds of Italian products, canned artichokes, tomatoes, pasta, everything. Our store was next to Tosi. Then south of us, there was a large hardware store with windows displays of toilet bowls. It closed down later and a one-ton shop took over. The next store belonged to the parents of my Strathcona classmate, whose last name was Durr. They operated a shoe repair shop. So heading to the end of the block at the northeast corner of Georgian Main Streets, my dad said that the Woodward store formerly occupied that spot many, many years ago, I think over 100 years ago. In my childhood, the space was rented as a drugstore and I would go there to read the comics. So that gives you an idea of the different kinds of businesses that were, you know, in our area. And later on, I remember three hair salons occupied our block. Therefore, there has been so many changes over the years as different businesses took over. I can still remember seeing Fei and Dean Liang. Fei is quite famous. And she was walking on the street and they were renting a real estate office in the Mandarin Towers across from our home. Fei Liang in her late 80s is quite a character. I hope you get to meet her one day. So every day after attending Strathcona Elementary School, I grudgingly had to go to Munkeong School from 4 to 6 when I preferred to stay home and play. I think Paul Yi probably felt the same. But now I'm very happy that my parents made me go as I learned to write Chinese characters and speak basic Cantonese. Table tennis time at recess was the best, and we would run downstairs to the shop to buy sweet ginger or preserved plums as our treat. One of the Pender Guide members, Paul Yi, attended Munkeong School with me. We had a lot of fun teasing each other. As part of our family ritual, we would head out in the evenings to watch double features at the Shaw Theater on Hastings Street, just north of Main Street. It was fun to watch the variety of movies offered. Kung Fu, using magical powers, historical dramas, black and white comedies, romances, or family intrigue. That was my education of Chinese culture at that time, a lot of Hong Kong influences. My parents might attend a Cantonese opera in which I had no interest. So I wandered about in the Majestic Theater, which was across from Army Navy stores. To me, it was shrieking noise to me. So as my dad got tired of cooking every day, we would take a break and go for a meal in one of the restaurants in Chinatown. I loved the food there, but usually on my birthday, we would head over to WK Gardens and order the beef and tomato fried noodle and fried oysters. That makes my mouth water just thinking about it. In conclusion, I feel so fortunate to live in the heart of Chinatown in Main Street. I felt very secure, surrounded by a large community of Chinese. My first language is actually the Toisan dialect spoken by the immigrants of the Pearl River Delta. I feel very proud of my heritage and the sacrifices my elders made in coming to Canada. As the younger generation, we are so blessed to have the ability to obtain education, work, and enjoy our democratic freedoms. So living in Chinatown impacted me positively. I am very proud of the area, and I hope the efforts to revitalize it nowadays will come to some kind of fruition. So as one of the Panda Guys members that actually live in the neighborhood, I contributed what I knew about my community. Chinatown was my daily life. Also participating in Panda Guy enriched my life greatly. Thank you everybody for listening to my story.
Thank you so much, Ginny. And now we're going to move to invite our young people from the current decade. First of all, I'm going to invite Christy to give us an idea how this whole project is being resurrected. Just a few words about this talented young person. Christy, I first met her when she was launching a short film documentary about barbecue pork. And this is called Under Fire, if I remember correctly. That's the name of the film that also won an award at the Vancouver Asian Film Festival. It won the Best Canadian Short Award in 2016. And then in 2017, she started to organize a listening party with Jun Chao and company. And that started this whole thing. Another amazing thing, you know the people around you, but you never really know a lot of the details and some of the fantastic things they do until you have an event like this. So I'm very grateful that Alan asked me to moderate this panel. And I learned so much about these people I think I know. So in 2017, she did a virtual field trip of Vancouver's Chinatown. And she did this for the academic journal, Canadian Literature. Thank you. So you have a lot of skills, Christy. Both your research skills and also your digital skills. And that comes in really handy for us. If we're going to start any project, we'll remember to look you up and persuade you to join. So I'm going to shut up and turn the microphone over to you, Christy.
Thank you so much, Benny. It's funny because your first memory is of the film with me, but my first memory of you is actually one time, it was actually before the film screening. You came over when I was sitting by myself in the Sunnyside Gardens and you asked me like how I was doing, if I was nervous. Like you actually reached out to me with all that kindness before you even watched the film. So I think that's a really big sign of what Chinatown has been like for me as a youth coming in for the very first time. Just the warmth, the connections, and all the willingness of the people there to share and help out. I'm genuinely so honored to be on this panel. It's full of people whose that I only knew as names on little handwritten index cards that are part of the Pendakai archives. I just remember reading over them and looking at all the different materials and being so fascinated. And now I actually get to hear your stories and see your faces and hear your, and all of this is just such an incredible experience. I almost want to use my time just to ask you all a million questions instead of going into my own experiences. But hopefully that can take place in the Pendakai Round 2 podcast. So we'll see. What I'll be doing today instead is bringing forward this timeline a few decades into 2015, a few years after the show has ended, but still having very much resonance for me in my life. I graduated from UBC with an English honors and Asian Canadian Asian migration minor, which was the start of my journey with Pendakai Radio. So this whole experience really starts with a story, and it starts with me, again, sitting in a Chinatown event by myself, feeling very lost, not knowing anybody or any of the legacies. And then Elder leans over and says to me, "Did you know that Chinatown saved barbecue meats?" And I was like, "We did? What is that? Tell me more about that." And he tells this incredible tale of how barbecue meats were almost banned in Vancouver, but all the Chinatowns across Canada came together and saved this precious food product. And it's still something that my family can enjoy on a weekly basis. And that actually led me into my thesis project on the myth status of the 1968 to 1979 barbecue meats protests here in Vancouver. And it led to the website and the documentary short that Winnie mentioned, and it completely transformed my life. What's really key is that none of that work would have been possible without the Pendakai radio show. Those tapes were some of the only primary documents that existed about these protests. There were some articles in the Vancouver Sun. There was one tiny paragraph actually in Salt Water City written by Paul Yee that I read 10,000 times trying to extract as many details as possible. And also one article in the unpublished manuscript that another Chinatown elder stuffed into my backpack and told me not to share with anybody, but I could read it for my own reference. So I think that speaks to how much of these stories are really interpersonal. And it's through these connections. So Chris Lee, who was my thesis supervisor and also director of the ACAM program, he knew April Liu, who worked at the Museum of Anthropology at UBC, who had just received the tapes and the materials for Wonomar's basement when she, I can't remember why how they got into the MOA. But at that point, it was just index cards, some of the posters, the t-shirts, and all the tapes were still in real format. And they couldn't be digitized by MOA because they were so fragile at that stage and they didn't have the equipment to actually digitize them without causing more damage to the physical tape itself. So that moment when I first opened that Pendakai box and I saw those vivid, like beautiful posters with the red stamps and all of the material, I was like, this is the stuff that we do now in Chinatown. Like, we're always trying to make t-shirts and posters and logos when we try to organize in Chinatown. And it was so great to see, it was so great to see that the elders now were once youth, like that they were also doing the same fun things, the same kind of, wow, how can we make it appealing and interesting for everybody? And I felt like I really had found a community across time when I opened that box for the very first, experience. And those handwritten index cards, the ones that I read every single one of the titles, I mean, now we're very lucky because through the efforts of Jun Chao and the Vancouver Archives, they're now all completely digitized. But that experience of reading those index cards and not being able to access those tapes was torture. The titles are so interesting. It's like Pendakai meets like this guy and then like this interview with this key figure. And then I just had so many I wanted to see. And through this kind of very obsessive reading of those index cards, I was able to meet Barry Wong. It's the same as everyone else. He was the one who also pulled me into my Pendakai radio journey. When I first mentioned this, Paul Yee actually described him as the brain and heart of Pendakai, and he is 100% that. When we first met, I told him who I was and what I was doing my research for. He sat me down and talked to me for 3 hours about like audio waves and space and time and gravitational waves. I think that we just discovered that gravitational waves are real, and he's explaining to me what that was and how it connects to the space-time transition of Pendakai. It was one of the most memorable conversations I've ever had in my life. And as part of that conversation, I was able to have, actually, I should go back on this. I didn't just magically have these digitized tapes I could then use in my research in my film. Barry bussed every day to that Chinatown museum in the cold, in the rain. This was part of the semester, so it was in the winter, where he would manually digitize all these films for me, take the bus out to UBC, where he had shrink-wrapped physical discs of the tapes, and then delivered them to me in my work office. He came all the way to my work office over in Canadian Literature, which is not accessible, by the way. It's like a 20-minute walk from the bus stop, and he had to like go into this basement, come knock on my door, and then give me those tapes. So sometimes when I hear, oh, Christy, wow, your film won an award, I'm like, I didn't win anything. Everyone else just put all that effort into giving me this knowledge and sharing all these stories. And all I had to do was pop open Adobe Premiere and then move around some audio and video things. All the work was in the community. And that's actually one of the tapes that I've selected for my excerpt. And that's number 80, which includes an interview with Barry Morgan, who is then the Federal Health Protection Minister, talking about why it was justified that the barbecue meats were banned in Chinatown. So it's a really fascinating interview. I would strongly recommend giving it a listen, especially now because they are in the Vancouver archives and will not require a very kind community member to do all that work for you in order to access them. So I was sitting on these series of tapes, I think around 5 to 6 of them, just kind of in my little red iPod, because back then you couldn't listen to music on your cell phone the way you can now. And I felt kind of guilty because he'd put all this work into giving me these tapes. And I didn't know what to do with them. I put them in my research, but only a small excerpt of it. And it just so happened that Rachel, who is also on this panel, is a good friend of mine, was doing a residency with Access Gallery, which is actually hosted in Chinatown. And they were also at CITR. They'll explain this better because they're involved in 10 million things. They were just my friend. They were like, hey, Christy, do you want to do something? And I was like, yes, I have 6 tapes from Pendergrass Radio. Let's bring that back into Chinatown. Let's do a listening party. And we were very lucky to work with Barry to select some of his favorite shows, design some discussion questions, and bring it back to Chinatown for the first time, I think, 30 years at the time of the radio party. So yeah, it was such an adventure. The whole thing has really been such a meaningful experience for me in finding community and in understanding the histories and feeling almost like I've been gifted something that I need to take care of now and re-gift back to the next generation. I know I'm a youth on this panel, but every year I become less youth and there are more youth rising up that would definitely love to hear these stories. That same elder that actually first told me about those protests and stuffed resources into my backpack, he recently gifted me a goji tree. And he told me to give it lots of light for growth and lots of water for nourishment and talk to it every now and again to help it grow better. And this makes me think of how these stories are kind of like that tree. And in the same way that I've been given this, it's now my responsibility to take care of them and to pass it on to other youths that I may end up mentoring. And yeah, so that's my Pendergai experience. I think there's going to be more, and I'm very much looking forward to what that will look like. I will pass it off to Rach to better explain the listening party, because they really made it all happen with the residency. So yeah, thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Christy. I love that energy that you brought to this program. So I'm going to invite Rachel to round this off. And Rachel uses the pronoun they, so I'm going to read a bit from what she has provided for me. Rachel is a community engaged artist, writer, and radio producer. They are using audio storytelling, photography, and so on and so forth to grapple with themes of resistance, longing, transience, death and decay, some really serious topics. As a radio producer, they have created several narrative radio documentaries focused on the work of marginalized communities, including past and present youth organizing in Vancouver's Chinatown. So this is where the hope comes from for us in Chinatown, with young people now taking over. And they are also a recent graduate of the Media Studies program and a minor in Asian Canadian and Asian Migration Studies at the University of British Columbia. And I stumble because I'm so old-fashioned, but I'm learning. So Rachel, off to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Winnie. And we're all learning, so we all stumble. And I'm so honored to be part of this panel. And it's funny because I've actually talked to Ramona and Paul on the phone before, back when I was a student, but I had never put a face to a voice until now. So I'm really excited to talk a little bit more about that. So the whole story with the listening party. So much like an elder had stuffed some like unpublished manuscripts in Christy's backpack and said, hey, do you know this? That kind of happened for me when I was in university, still at UBC, and studying in the media studies program and the Asian Canadian Asian Migration Studies program. So I was a young microphone carrying nerd, as Ramona had said at the time. And so I was involved with CITR, which is UBC's community campus radio station. And at the time we were part of the Plot residency at Access Gallery on East Georgia Street. And at the time I was the spoken coordinator of CITR student executive. So having grown up in Vancouver's Chinatown, my mom had a business in Sunhwa Center on Kiefer Street. I went there after school every day. I would go across the street to like Maxim's to get food. And my mom would remind me to make sure the change was right, like things like that. I was really connected to the community. And so I really wanted to do something related to Chinatown and radio during that time that we were at Access Gallery as a radio station. And so what happened was, June Chow, who much like that elder, as I was talking about, talked to Christy, I asked June, okay, is there anything that's Chinatown and radio related? And June Chow essentially said two things: Pendergast Radio, talk to Christy Fong. Two words. And so Christy and I had already been good friends at that point. And so it was a really natural connection between the two of us to get something started. And Christy had told me about the work that she had done with Under Fire and working with Barry and the tapes that she had access to. And I said, great, let's make this happen. And so that's how the listening party came to be. And I'll post a little link here so folks can see the design of the poster and what we talked about at the event. But it was actually inspired by the Pendergast ephemera that we saw at MOA with the stamp and the logo. And so we took a riff on that design to make the poster for the listening party. And what we had done at the listening party was that we had clips of the Pendergast episodes, and Christy and I had facilitated this sort of discussion and listening party at Access Gallery. And part of the reason for that was because we wanted to think through what it meant, the fact that Chinatown was this change in community, especially with the rise of gentrification and how art spaces might be contributing to that. So we wanted to kind of envelop all that complexity into this listening party and for members of the community, old and new in Chinatown, to consider all those things together. So that was a really unique and fun time at the Pendergast Radio listening party. And everyone was really thrilled to hear the tapes for the first time in 30 years, 3 decades. And so actually what happened was, after that listening party, it inspired me to create a radio documentary called The Young and the Resistant. I actually riffed off of the name The Young and the Restless, if folks are familiar with this long-standing soap opera on daytime television. So the reason why I created this radio documentary at the time was, this was actually around 2017, 2018, was the height of the 105 Kiefer Street fights in Vancouver's Chinatown. And for those who aren't familiar, it's essentially a lot that is right behind or right across from Chinatown's Memorial Square and right across from Sun Yat-sen Garden and Chinese Cultural Center. And there was a development that was being proposed of primarily market condos. And there was a huge uprise and resistance from the community against this development for fear of further gentrification of the neighborhood. And so there was a lot of youth organizing at that time to bring elders together, community members together, to speak at City Hall and push back against this proposal. And so it was through that that I was inspired to kind of look into the history of youth organizing in Vancouver's Chinatown. And that's how I learned about the work of Pendergast and Ramona's work, you know, inquiring into the discotheque that was acting in a discriminatory way against Chinese Canadians, and also Paul Yee's work with Pendergai in general. And so I decided to do this thing where I fused the past and present, and I interviewed youth activists, dear friends of mine, Yolanda Lui and Amanda Wan. Yolanda is actually the founder of Yarrow Intergenerational Society for Justice, who's doing really great work in Vancouver's Chinatown as a social service organization. And then I also interviewed Ramona and Paul over the phone about this documentary to bring all of those things together. And that was a really great experience for me to see that, you know, even though time has passed, that that spirit and that energy of youth organizing in Chinatown remains the same. And so, you know, that kind of energy gets carried across generations and it still remains, I think, even today. Unfortunately, at the time, I didn't get to include the actual Pendergai radio clips in the documentary itself because of the kind of murkiness around copyright. But now that it's public, Christy and I are talking about all the things that we want to do or revisit. And so I'm hoping that I could make another The Young and the Resistant Revisited to include those clips and perhaps new interviews with all of you here who have taken the time to attend the panel. I'm mindful of the time, so I want to save room for Q&A, but that's what I wanted to share about the listening party and the radio documentary, and it's such a pleasure to be on this panel with all of you. Thank you.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Rachel. Let us give a round of applause to everyone here on the panel. Thank you so much. Now, time is short, and we do have quite a few comments on Q&A, plus a couple of questions. So if our speakers, especially the elders, because there's one question addressed to the elders by Alyssa, please take a look at that question about intergenerational space indicate you want to speak and just unmute yourself. I think there's another question from Wendy Yip, asking whether there's any Chinese language radio stations, which could be a partner. You can read that yourself. If one of you could answer it, then you can elaborate on it. Okay. Now, before you start answering question, I also want to acknowledge that there are probably more than one alumni among the audience. At least there's one that I know, that's Tang Chen Adong. If Adong wants to speak, let Sophie know and she will put you on the screen and then I will give you a minute. Okay, anyone want to answer those two questions? The elders. Oh, okay, Adong is here. So, Adong.
Hello, so happy to be here.
So what did you do among on that program?
Well, actually, I kind of introduced the whole idea to people, because at that time there was a guy by name Ban Liang. He got I think about 4 hours from the CRVRO, and he has extra time. He can't produce it, and he wants to see if the group of people would like to take it over, and so we did. And I think Tommy and Paul and we'll probably remember that, and we had the discussion, and so we took it over. And at that time, my English was so poor. If I were to go in front of the microphone, people wouldn't understand what I was saying. You probably couldn't understand what I'm saying either now. But that's the story back then. And so if you ask Paul and Barry and people in the front at the beginning, the first 3 or 4 months, you probably would remember all those chewing gums. I was behind the booth with Don Yi, and Barry was there and helping as well. One credit we probably should give is beyond the people involved with Jim Wong Chu and others at the beginning, the government actually, Canadian government actually gave a grant, a summer student grant, that actually allowed Pendergai to have people like Tommy and myself and Anthony and a few other people. Tommy probably will remember more, of actually getting paid for a summer job. And that's how Pendergai was able to grow. So we were able, and Success was a sponsor for that program. So, listening back to the stories, it just touches me. What touched me more though is seeing the young folks, Rachel and Christy, and wanting to continue to that work. One thing that's unique about Panda Guy, and I don't know if it's able to continue on, is the cooperation between the first generation, the new immigrants like Tommy and I and Anthony, and work with the native points. I don't see too much of that happening now, so maybe Christy and Rachel can explain why. I'll shut up now.
Okay, thank you so much, Tung. I also want to point out that even though we are not able to play the clips today because, one, time constraint, two, we figure that you can always listen to the tapes on your own. It's more important we give time for the storytellers here. Yet Ellen, with the help of Elwin Xie, would be preparing the recording to make it recording of this session. And there would be all the links, all the different clips that have been referred to embedded in the description of that recording. So you can listen to those clips after you have reviewed the recording of this conversation. Okay, so thank you to Adam and Elwin for doing that. Now, elders, you should not shy away. Hey, I do see Tommy putting his hand up. So probably Elder Tommy will be answering the question. Good.
I would just like to say a word in reply to Alicia's question about intergeneration discourse. I won't offer it as advice, but as something that I've learned myself, that if you do get the opportunity, seize it and don't let it pass. Keep an open mind. These older folks like myself, you know, if you let an opportunity pass by, you won't have it again because they don't last forever. They don't last for very long, actually, you know. And give them time because older folks like me appear boring and appear to have nothing interesting to say, but in fact, they do have lots of stories if you poke them, if you give them time. Yeah, they are not as boring as they appear to be, you know, right?
Yes, Paul. Paul, you have to unmute yourself.
There, is that better?
Yes.
Okay, so anyways, to acknowledge what Chitung said about how Panda Guy started, yes, indeed, there was an opening at Co-op Radio, but more to the point was really that it came out of a conference. You know, we were just talking, we had brought together young people, the Canadian-born and the immigrants to talk about, you know, this gap between us. But we also realized that talking could only get us so far because you just debate these sort of intellectual cerebral issues. What we were looking for was something to work on, something concrete. And that became a program, that became Panda Guy, the radio program. That's how Tommy did this, was carrying over the between us from that very conference. So I see Cindy.
Yes, Cindy wants to show something. What is that, Cindy? Cindy, you have to unmute yourself, please. No, we still don't hear. Cindy.
Technical idiot.
Yes, yes, yes.
Paul, is that the one you're talking about? Let's see, there. No?
It's hard to see, okay. Hard to read the print.
I have in my files a whole bunch of stuff from the beginning of Panda Guy. I wasn't part of Panda Guy because I opted to go and study at the School of Architecture instead. But I have a whole bunch of stuff, and I think this is the original pamphlet, Paul, that you're talking about. Anyways.
Well, it looks like now we have discovered a lot more people have in their attics. They are bringing them out. And so if people want to do research on this program and maybe people are inspired to do something, a new rendition of efforts like what you guys did 40 some years ago, there's a lot of material for them to look at. Did Ramona put up her hand earlier? Yes, please unmute yourself.
Just briefly to answer Wendy's question, no, I don't believe anyone has gone to see if we could get anything translated. I just want to address, because I was there at the end, as to why Pendergai folded. We were exhausted. I think there were probably a core of five of us left at the end. We tried to recruit. We sent out these posters, we begged for people, and probably because most of us were in university at the time and we were finishing off that and starting careers, we just ran dry, and we sadly agreed to fold it. And by then we were a 1.5-hour program shortened up from the live program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so even though this program closed, all of you individually and sometimes together, we're doing other things.
Absolutely. I think every one of us went on to do other projects. I mean, you know, a lot of us were with Paul in Saltwater City. We did 125 celebrations. We joined Tommy's campaign. You know, we certainly kept community throughout our lives. To this day, as an elder, that's all.
We better get used to that terminology now.
Elder is not a derogatory term.
No, it's very nice. It's still a shock, you know?
Exactly. And I was also going to speak to Wendy's question as well. When Christy and I were talking yesterday, we were talking about how originally when we had organized the listening party in 2017, we were hoping to organize a Chinese language version of that with Cantonese and Mandarin interpretation in spring of 2018. But life kind of got to us, as it did for the original Pendergai team. So, I mean, now that the clips are public, I think that possibility is so much greater. So hopefully, look out, maybe in the post-pandemic world, there'll be a Chinese language version of a Pendergai party.
Yes, that would be wonderful. Now I'm mindful of the time, and I wonder if anyone, whether you are young person or an elder, would you like to add anything to this before we conclude? Yes, Paul.
I think this program was very unexpected to have this program draw out the emotions from me. I mean, Pendergai was long forgotten in my mind, but today's session has made me very emotional, has confirmed what I've always believed in. And I thank people like Christy and Rachel for doing that, because it really is about, you know, we look at community, and community is people, and it's about generations of people. So it's really enheartening for me to see that people are coming forward and saying, yeah, we want to do something here too. You know, when we left, we had no idea what was going to happen. Chinatown had its own life, and we were just, you know, pawns just moving through. But it's so reassuring to see that people are taking up, you know, the torch or whatever, and doing new and interesting and important things. I followed the 105 Kiefer Street thing, and I thought, wow, this is amazing. And Vancouver has always been the heart of so much of sort of Chinese Canada's heart in terms of the issues that go on, in terms of the history and the focus. You know, people look to Vancouver for inspiration, for direction, all of that. And because it's positioned, you know, between, you know, China, Hong Kong, and Vancouver, and then all the way over to Toronto, you know, that's why Vancouver is such an important place. And that's why, you know, things like Pendergai will probably only happen in Vancouver. Enough. Thank you, Rachel. Thank you, Christy. Really, from my heart.
Yeah. Anyone else want to add anything? No? Well then, I am so thankful that we have this technology that brings us together. And even though it would be so good if we could actually meet face to face, but I'm just so happy that this could bring us together, and watching and listening to each other this way, I think is different. If we are in the same room and we're drinking and eating something, sometimes we got distracted. But now we have 100% of your attention and my attention while you speak. And I'm just very happy, very, very happy and grateful. And thank you to everyone who's pulled this together and for you responding to us and to our audience. And I know there are people also watching from Europe. So maybe some of you will recognize the names of the people and you can talk to them afterwards. Okay, so we promise ACWW.